Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The founders of our nation placed a great deal of trust in the role of a free press as the key to maintaining informed public opinion. That's one reason the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights says, quote, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press. Thomas Jefferson went a bit further, quote, were it left to me to decide whether to have a government without newspapers or newspapers without government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Given those high expectations, it's worth taking a close look at the state of our nation's press, past, present, and future. Chuck Johnson is in a good position to do that. He was a newspaper reporter for 44 years. Chuck, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to do it.
Tell us a little about your background. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Helena. My dad was an insurance underwriter. My mom was a homemaker. Went to Helena High School, graduated in 1966.
Those were serious journalistic times, among other things.
Well, I worked on the school newspaper, but really? I wasn't paying that close of attention to the national trends. But we won an all-state award for our Helena High Nugget that year, and we were all pretty happy.
What attracted you to journalism at that stage of your life?
I grew up in a household where there were a lot of newspapers read. We always got the Independent Record, which was an afternoon daily at the time, and we got the Tribune, which was the morning paper. My parents often picked up the Sunday Spokesman Review, which you could get on the newsstands. When I visited my grandfather in Billings, he got the Billings Gazette, he and my grandmother, and he was from the Midwest and picked up a daily copy of the Chicago Tribune from the newsstand down there, a day old, but mainly because he was a huge Chicago Cubs fan. But he was a strong Democrat and hated their editorial page. The Tribune was a leading Republican newspaper at the time. So I grew up reading a lot of newspapers.
College?
I went to the University of Montana, got an undergraduate degree in journalism. I was managing editor of the student newspaper there. I was the sports editor of the paper prior to that. I originally wanted to be a sports writer and gave that up in favor of covering hard news.
Why?
And I still enjoy sports, but I was in school at the time of the Vietnam War. Watergate was around the corner. I just thought that was more interesting to me than sports.
So from your undergrad journalism degree, what'd you do?
I went to graduate school in history. It took me a while to finish my degree. I was always getting internships and jobs for a quarter here, a quarter there. So I didn't finish my thesis and graduate for 8 years, but I got a lot of good experience along the way.
You found synthesis or not between the study of history and your interest in journalism?
Absolutely.
How so?
I had decided I wanted to stay in Montana, and my history mentor and advisor was K. Ross Toole.
The name rings a bell.
Yeah, and he had a lot to say about the press in Montana as part of his courses in Montana history.
Okay, what did he have to say about the press in Montana?
Well, he was highly critical of the role the Anaconda Company played in the press in Montana. They owned most of the major dailies for 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
Excluding the Great Falls Tribune, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle. But they owned all the papers now owned by Lee. And in the early years, he pointed out that they played an active role trying to decide which candidates they wanted to win elections. But over time, it was just the big gray press, he put it. They really wanted to control things, but they didn't try to control who was elected. The papers were pretty mediocre in those days.
Very, very interesting, because that's an example of something the founders didn't figure or didn't anticipate. The press as an agent of political control as opposed to an agent of political information upon which democracy could be based.
That's true, Brian, although the early papers around the time the Constitutional Convention and the Declaration of Independence took place and the early elections were extremely partisan, almost party rags. If people think the politics are nasty now, they should go back and read about those papers. They were vicious. But each party had its kind of party machinery to do that. It was part of partisan politics.
Yeah, well, I've read recently a biography of Washington, which makes that point in spades, and he, for one, was shocked. He was part of it. He had his faction, but they didn't expect it going in, I would say, it seems from what they wrote and talked about, but they certainly ran into it. And in Lincoln's time, I guess, in the Civil War, before the Civil War, the electioneering was very, very harsh.
It was, and pretty vicious, really throughout the 19th century. And then at some point it got to the point of so-called objective journalism, where reporters would cover the news and the editorial board would be sort of separated from the newsroom by a Berlin Wall of sorts. That there were no connections really between the two.
What period is that?
I think starting in the 1900s, I think that's the model that evolved over time, that they were money-making operations. The news side would cover the news, the editorial side would write the editorials. And now the Anaconda Company papers originally, it was very intermingled.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories are told that the editors would call the sixth floor of the Hennessy building in Butte, the headquarters of the Anaconda Company, to get their directions on what stories would run where. And
wow.
And in the early days, which politicians to go after and which to support.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with veteran reporter Chuck Johnson about the history of newspapers and media in America. You mentioned internships while you were going for your master's. Anything particularly significant in that experience?
I did have a Sears Congressional internship the first year that the company had them, and we went back and were assigned to work for a congressman or senator, and at night took journalism classes and were freed up to cover a hearing or two every week. And then Sears paid for this journalism professor who brought in some of the national reporters who'd covered the same hearing. So it was very, very educational.
In what respect was it educational?
Well, we could see the background they brought to the stories. We had people like Roger Mudd, prominent Washington reporters would come in and we'd compare our stories with what they had done. And of course, they had been there for years and knew all the players, which we didn't. And so their stories reflected that kind of background and background of experience.
All right. Now, does that lead me to the correct conclusion that in your experience, because you became Roger Mudd of Montana, let's say, that background and experience makes a difference in the quality of reporting?
No question about that, Brian. I think I was a much better reporter as time went on than I was initially. You get to know sources. You get to know the background of why certain laws are that way, what the forces were that pushed for passage of the laws and pushed against passage. You get to know the players. You get to watch the dynamics of legislation, and I think that helped a lot.
What was your first newspaper job in Montana?
First full-time newspaper job was working at the Missoulian, although I'd covered the Constitutional Convention for AP, but that was a...
Really?
Yeah.
How was that? Anything particularly interesting?
It was fascinating. It was at a time of reform in Montana. I'd worked a summer for AP as a summer help, and the bureau chief asked if I'd like to cover the Constitutional Convention, which I jumped at, which is one of the reasons I didn't finish my master's on time. And it was probably the most fascinating experience of my career.
That's quite a statement. Why?
It was a time of a lot of change in Montana. You had a lot of things going on. You had a budding environmental movement. You had the 18-year-old vote. You had the women's movement. You had Montanans that were sort of tired of the control that the Anaconda Company and Montana Power had exercised. Through a series of circumstances, including a Supreme Court decision, sitting legislators were ineligible to run.
To run for the convention delegate?
Correct. So the people that ran were not connected to the system for the most part. Some had been former legislators or city council members or county commissioners. So it opened the door to a lot of good citizens. I mean, there was a beekeeper, a disc jockey, a Catholic priest, a Methodist minister in Helena, George Harper. You had a conglomeration of people that were there to do good, and it varied a lot from the legislature. It was a totally open process. They didn't allow lobbyists on the floor. They required lobbyists to report their expenditures, which the legislature had never done before that. They set about to do their business and wrote what I think is still considered one of the best constitutions in the country among state governments.
And after the convention?
I was in the Army briefly and then worked for the Missoulian for a couple years. I was their political reporter and did special projects.
Political reporter. We all pledge allegiance to the Constitution, and most of us, if you look at the polls, don't have much respect for politics or politicians. I'm not saying that's a fair perception. Were you surprised at anything when you started covering politics in Montana, positive, negative, anything?
Well, I was surprised how open people were at that point, and Missoula being one of the larger cities, everyone stopped by there, and I covered the primary race in 1974 between Max Baucus, Pat Williams, and Arnold Olson. Olson had been a congressman. Williams was later a congressman, and Baucus won the seat. So that was really interesting to see three prominent people like that square off. Mike Mansfield would pay regular visits to the Missoulian. He'd come back every couple of years. And the first time I interviewed him at the Missoulian, it was on a Saturday, and I was off, and the city editor called me and asked me to come in because Mansfield had showed up there without any announcement ahead of time. And I was driving to the paper and trying to figure out a good question to ask him that wouldn't make me look like a dumbbell. And it was October of 72, and the Paris peace talks were going on. Nixon was running for president re-election under the theme of peace is at hand. George McGovern was critical. So I asked how the Paris peace talks were going and whether we were going to get peace before the election in Vietnam. And he asked if he could borrow a phone and went across the newsroom and pulled out a book and made a call and was on the phone for a few minutes and came back. And he said, well, I just talked to Henry Kissinger. So I got an up-to-date report on the Paris peace talks. And I had to have to say I wondered if he was pulling my leg, but the reporter over there had heard him call the White House and ask for Henry Kissinger. So he had a knack of stopping by. He didn't come back to Montana very often, but he would leave a national story every place he did, in Great Falls and Billings and Helena and Butte and Missoula, and was a fascinating guy to talk to.
And after the Missoulian?
I came to the Lee State Bureau in Helena, covered state government and politics and state issues for the Missoulian, Billings Gazette, Helena Independent Record, and the Montana Standard in Butte.
And that was for a fair period of time.
I was there from 74 until 77, then worked for the Tribune until 92, and then back with Lee.
In the same capacity?
Yes, a state house reporter.
All right, that's a lot of time. How was that job?
Well, it's very interesting. One of the stories I covered heavily in the early days was the whether Montana Power and other utilities should be allowed to build two power plants out in Colstrip called Colstrip 3 and 4. And there were many hearings and great disputes over whether the power plant should be allowed. There'd been the North Central Power Plan a few years earlier that had called for building of a federal plan that had called for building dozens of power plants out in eastern Montana and many coal generation stations. And this was a major issue in Montana politics for 3 or 4 years. It went to the Board of Natural Resources and Conservation, the Board of Health and Environmental Sciences. The Public Service Commission ultimately did not include in Montana Power's rate base its share of Colstrip 4. So it was a huge issue. The director of DNRC at the time was a guy named Gary Wicks, and they made the first recommendation. He recommended against building the power plants and called for mining the coal and shipping it out of state by rail. Well, that's still an issue today.
It certainly is.
So things, what I found is a lot of issues are never settled. They come back over the years, and that was certainly one of them.
In terms of your experience, you talked about the 20th century and the firewall between editorial and reporting. Was that your experience throughout your press time?
Yeah, I didn't see it come down much. What I did see happen over the years is, in later years, we saw fewer reporters. Newspapers hit a real tough time after the internet came around and lost a lot of readership and advertising. People found they could read the stories for free on the internet. So they did, and it took newspapers in Montana and elsewhere a while to figure out they better start charging for it or they wouldn't have any revenue coming in to pay their staffs.
We'll talk about that at some length. You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about the history of the press with veteran reporter Chuck Johnson. Before we get to the net, let's talk some more about the realities of your job as a reporter. The firewall pretty much there between editorial and reporting. What about the political dynamics of the state? I've been here 27 years. I have seen examples of federal and state officials who didn't like press coverage and got on the phone or went down to the editorial office and raised hell. I don't know what happened after that. I didn't hear it from the reporters. How often has that happened? Is that a factor, or are there other factors that limit the discretion of the reporters in looking for the hard stories?
There certainly were instances where federal and state officials were not happy with what certain reporters reported on uncertain issues. Sometimes they would directly tell the reporters and you would hash it out with them. More likely they'd go to publishers or editors and complain. Some of the best people I worked for never told us that had happened. They just said our reporters are doing their jobs and we will back them up. The old line, we stand by the story. There are certainly cases where there were a lot of pressure put on editorial editors and publishers, but I never had an instance where I was told to lay off someone or don't cover this or don't cover that. Sometimes when we worked in bureaus with several reporters, sometimes we'd say, you know, maybe you ought to cover this one for a while, or maybe I ought to cover this one, just to mix things up sometimes.
Now, that could mean a lot of things. It might mean that a reporter, him or herself, was thinking, I'm upset about this and I might not be objective. What did it mean?
That's one example. There were examples where I worked where someone might have a conflict of interest. Someone's spouse may be working for a candidate or working for an elected official, or in my case, my wife, Pat Hunt, was the daughter of a Supreme Court Justice, Bill Hunt. I quit when we started going out, I quit covering the Supreme Court. So there are some self-imposed changes like that. There were also instances where we just thought someone else might do a better job given the circumstances. So we would switch off beats from time to time and do things along that line.
I grew up in a small town in Northern California, and I would say you didn't read much bad. Not saying there was a heck of a lot going on, but there was always some level of malfeasance somewhere. And I felt that the editor, who was a great guy, he defined the purpose of the newspaper as supporting the community, and bad news was not, in his view, supportive of the community. In other words, there was a sort of built-in favorable bias. This is a small-town state. Is that a past, or when I say past, during your career, did you see that thing as a significant phenomenon where people would back off because Joe's a good friend of mine, he's a rancher, or he's a this or that, that sort of personal thing, or was it professional in your judgment?
My opinion, it was professional. Now, we were in the bureau, so we were somewhat isolated from the newsrooms. We worked in separate locations most of the time.
I didn't know what bureau meant.
Well, when I was at the Lee Bureau, the first time we had three reporters. When I was at the Tribune, we had two or three reporters, then one. And then when I was back at Lee, we had three and then went down to two. And sometimes we had an intern during the legislature. So we were eventually moved into the Independent Record Building in the 4 or 5 years before I retired. But prior to that, we were in separate locations.
Meaning, what's the relevance of that to good old boyism?
Well, we we were across town. We weren't there to see who was coming to visit the editor and publisher.
I see. So you were independent, in other words.
We felt so.
When you look back, again, 4+ decades, are there experiences or stories that you covered, either alone or as part of the team, that mean something to you after all this time?
Yes. And some of these were written with other people, but I think I and others did a good job of covering one of the major stories of the era, which was the proposal by Montana Power Company to deregulate itself, and it eventually led to the company selling its power plants and dams, and of course eventually led to its successor company, Touch America, to file bankruptcy, and the company that bought some of the utility, Northwestern Energy, to file for bankruptcy too. That was a huge story, and I think the Montana media did a good job. I think all of us did a good job covering dark money when it came about, when we found groups were finding ways to get money in the political process and not reporting the source of the money. And that's an ongoing story with no end in sight, although in the 2015 legislature, the state passed a strong a bill called the Disclose Act that, if it stands, should help solve that problem. I was always interested in covering budget and tax stories, in part because during a lot of the years I was there, there was always a state revenue shortage.
You mean revenue, the taxes, we're operating a deficit budget?
Well, we never had a deficit budget because the state constitution requires a balanced budget, but there were always projected shortfalls. So in the 80s, for instance, the state was having to call special sessions to readjust the budget, lower the budget to meet declining revenues when the oil and gas prices declined.
Mm-hmm. Why was the revenue story of significance to you, looking back?
The cuts that had to be made because of the shortfall in revenues affected programs that dealt with human services to poor people and elderly people. They affected state agencies' budgets. I also like to do stories on the state tax system and who the winners and losers were from various tax cuts that were proposed. Mm. And oftentimes, under some governors, the winners were the best-off people in society, and to some extent, the losers were those least well-off.
The two examples you pick are certainly current. Cutbacks in programs for the poor and the elderly, and then tax breaks under certain situations for the wealthier. Do I impute a personal view on those issues that affected your reporting, or what would you say?
No, I just felt that readers should know who wins and who loses, so to speak, from these decisions and the politics behind why they were made.
Getting back to the internet, I was at a conference 5 or 6 years ago that indicated that the financial difficulties of the private press were such that 35,000 in the nation, 35,000 less press reporters were on the staff after a 10-year period, a major loss. Did you see any of that? Do you think that's exaggerated? Or if it did happen, what's the consequence of reduced press presence, reporting presence?
Yes, Brian, it's happened in Montana. There are fewer reporters at some newspapers than there were a decade ago. The consequence is that the fewer reporters that are left have to cover more topics, and I think you can assume in some cases that the coverage isn't as deep, as wide as it might have been.
Is that significant to you or not?
I think so. I think it's hurt newspapers that they're not able to cover with the same depth and breadth that they have before. And there are other factors too. Like I said, the internet has allowed people to get news on their tablets, their personal computers, their phones, from a variety of sources, the national sources to local sources. And the daily newspaper in a town maybe isn't as important as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. There are multiple sources out there.
So with a reduction in local press presence, reporting presence, what can be done or what is being done?
Well, some former daily newspaper reporters have formed free online news sites. Ed Kemick has the Last Best News in Billings. John Adams has the Montana Free Press website that he's actually providing some of his content to the newspapers around the state, weekly and daily.
How does he or either one of them support themselves?
That is really the question. I think John has just started this, and I think he hopes to monetize it at some point. Mm-hmm. Ed Kemick's been going since 2014, and I think he's able to support himself. He's joined forces with a fellow named David Crisp, who had a weekly newspaper down there
right.
for 18, 20 years called the Billings Outpost.
That almost sounds like a startup of AP without having to pay for it.
I think that's what it is at the moment, although mm-hmm. I think John Adams hopes to eventually find a way to be paid for his services.
Sure.
Because, after all, he's got to get paid, and he's got expenses associated with running a news operation. Another one just formed in Missoula by Martin Kidston, a veteran Montana reporter,
right.
called Missoula Current. And he covers the local scene pretty well, and I don't know where that's headed. I don't know. Both Kemick and Kidston's websites have advertising, whereas I think John Adams is hoping to go the nonprofit route and get grants from nonprofit foundations.
44 years is a fair piece of time. You look back on that, how do you feel about it? How do you feel about it in terms of your expectations, what you accomplished, what you didn't? What's it feel like to Chuck Johnson?
I felt privileged to be able to cover Montana at a time of great change. I enjoyed every day of it. I witnessed a lot of interesting history, and in my own way, I guess, helped shape it by choosing what to cover and what not to cover. I interviewed a lot of prominent Montana politicians and tried to look at what they were proposing and analyze it, and I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Going back to my introduction and the founder's expectations, do you feel, romance aside, you've had 44 years too long for romance, that it matters, that what you communicated to the citizenry matters in a democracy?
Absolutely. I feel that the press, in whatever form it is, plays a huge role in Montana and the nation and the world.
Chuck Johnson, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. I enjoyed it too.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week.
Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.